Okay, good morning and welcome to this session of the Sunstone Symposium 2006, Reflections on Goodbye, I Love You. Today, we have the opportunity to hear from Carolyn Pearson. Carolyn Pearson is an author and performer living in Walnut Creek, California. She is known for a wide variety of published works, including over 30 books ranging from poetry to fiction and from history to comedy. For the past decade, she's been performing a one-woman play, Mother Wove the Morning, in which she plays 16 women throughout history in search of the female face of God. In 1986, Random House published her book, Goodbye, I Love You, the story of her life with her husband, a homosexual man, their 12-year marriage, their four children, their divorce, their friendship, and of her caring for him in her home as he died of AIDS. That book sold over 40,000 in hard copy and well over 100,000 in paperback. We're fortunate to hear her today as she reflects on this book some 20 years later. So please welcome with me Carolyn Pearson.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming to participate with me here in this session this morning. I really intend to leave quite a bit of time at the end for the questions that I'm sure many of you have. I was reminded just a moment ago by a gentleman here, wow, he said 20 years ago, he said, I remember that evening session at Sunstone where I first presented here. As I was on a book tour, just as Goodbye, I Love You had come out. He said it was an overflowing crowd, and it was pretty big. And I remember that evening, of course, and I do remember how scary that was. You know, it's always scary to get up and speak, but when you're doing something kind of out of the ordinary, like was happening then, that was a very frightening time. And I remember how terrified I was, most especially when my editor from Random House called and told me that Deseret Book had called and asked for a preview copy of the book to read. And I went into big time panic, and I said, oh my gosh, I am not ready for this. I am just not ready for this. I truly did not know what was going to be coming of all that. And then I remember about 2 weeks later when she called and said, Deseret Book has ordered 1,000 copies of Goodbye, I Love You, and they have also asked if you would be willing to be to sign books at an autograph session during something they call General Conference. And I remember that I was so relieved and so moved, I hung up and I burst into tears. And just thinking about that moment is still very moving to me, because I was scared to death. And of course I went into it knowing that it was an important thing to do and believing that the major response would be positive rather than negative. Nevertheless, I was scared to death. And when that affirmative vote came in that Deseret Book wanted 1,000 copies and wanted me to sign, I truly just thanked the heavens. I did indeed receive so much more positive response from all that than negative. I was prepared for a significant negative minority response, and I was surprised that what I did get that was negative was really much less than I'd ever thought. I began to put all of the letters that I received in different categories. I had a file for LDS gay man, LDS wife of gay man, LDS lesbian and or non-LDS parent or whatever. And as I began to fill up those folders, I realized that the file that was getting the largest of them all was one that I had marked LDS General, meaning that these were people who did not have a gay child, who were not gay themselves, who had not been married to a gay person, but wanted to thank me for helping them to understand something that they had just not been able to get a handle on. And that was extraordinarily rewarding to me, of course. Well, since then, obviously, I have devoted quite a significant part of my time to maintaining that opening that I created there of being able to bring into my life a lot of, especially in the Mormon community, gay people and their families, women who had been married to gay men or still were, occasionally a man who had been married to a lesbian Mormon woman. And it's been a very rich journey, and I'm grateful that I have been able to participate in all that and to be a benefit, as I know has been the case for so many people. And my wonderful daughter Emily is here, and I'm grateful that my family has survived all of the difficult things that have gone on here. And I have to believe that we've had a calling, as I think so many of you have a particular calling in the kind of thing that speaks to you. And I think we were moved to hear the last session up here with Buckley and with Jeffrey Nielsen, the interesting, charming, brave Mormon BYU professor who put his career on the line. I'm very moved when I meet people like that. And clearly, he had a calling to do what he has been doing. And he recognized that very clearly because he's been in the mode of looking at ethics and being able to respond, this is the ethical thing to do, and I must do it. So many people in this room have their own calling. And I don't remember asking for the calling that I do believe that I have been given here, but my husband Gerald assured me in many conversations that he and I must have signed up for a big project. And he was always very sorry that it was so painful. But he said, you know that we, especially you, have an important work to do. You know, Gerald's the one who set me up being a writer. He's the one, I mean, only a gay man could be outrageously foolish enough to want to borrow money and publish his wife's little book of poems. So that's, you know, truly, without that, I really doubt that I would have had a career writing, you know, an occasional article for the Ensign or something like that. But I do owe him an enormous amount in professionally as well as in many other ways. So I do not resent the calling that I have. And I had thought really that my calling was over when I wrote Goodbye, I Love You, and when I continued to maintain with all of the good people who have come into my life. But it became clear to me, I don't know, a couple of years ago maybe, that perhaps I wasn't through with this subject. You know, especially as I saw, despite the amount of progress that, yes, society has made, and the amount of progress that, yes, the LDS community has made, especially as a group and to some small extent in the ecclesiastical church, despite whatever progress, there still is just way too much pain, way too much human suffering for anybody to say it is okay. And you know all the pain that I'm talking about, most dramatically the suicides. So I felt myself called back to addressing the subject. At the same time that I found myself kind of called back to my first love of writing, which was playwriting. And about a year and a half ago, I found myself writing a play that I really felt would be able to find a home for production. And indeed it has. I hope that many of you have received the little flyer that is available. On the play that is going to be presented by Plan B Theater in November, the 16th through the 26th, write that down in your Franklin Day Planner, or your good little Franklin Day Planner, or it's going to be a very interesting and meaningful and important event. Jerry Rapier of Plan B is going to do a fine job, I know. And that is the story of a Mormon family dealing with the suicide of their gay son. So having written that play, it suddenly occurred to me, my word, this year, 06, is the 20th anniversary of the publication of Goodbye, I Love You, and I'm going to have a lot of publicity in Utah around that play. And why in the world don't I have a book ready? So I decided, well, just do it. So I have written a book. I have focused pretty much solely on that for the last 6 months or so. And I'm not waiting in line for a publisher to do this. I am publishing it myself. You know, Gerald and I have published Beginnings by ourselves. And this book is going to be offered over the internet, which is the way that many, many people buy their books these days. So this book will be available in November. And the title, as many of you have received the little flyer that's out here, No More Goodbyes, Circling the Wagons Around Our Gay Loved Ones. And of course, watching the continual goodbyes that still are said over this subject has been devastating to me. And to know that the tiny steps forward, well, the very meaningful and very important steps forward that our community has made are not to be discounted in any means. All of the organizations that have formed, many of which were certainly formed prior to my writing Goodbye, I Love You, but the ongoing progress of individual Mormon people and organizations, and the gathering in strength of the such organizations as Family Fellowship that and others that are doing such a really excellent job of giving a place for, especially for families who have gay children, to know that they're not alone, of giving them support. All of these wonderful things are indeed in place. And in spite of that, there is still so much pain, way too much pain. And it was easy for me to identify the three specific goodbyes that I still see being said, to my mind, so unnecessarily. Now, we have a mortal condition that is going to be imperfect for as long as we're here. And so we're always going to have unfortunate things happening. But so many of them are predictably, just should not be. If we had a higher consciousness. And so I have addressed in this book the goodbyes that yet are said to family alienation, to ill-fated marriages, and to suicide. I've been so grateful to have so many people bring their lives to me and to respond to the call for stories that I sent out. But I had only to go back into my huge personal diary, into my file of letters, into my email, to be able to gather up so many little bits of the human heart that are so precious and that I found so compelling. And I felt, again, so privileged to be able to create a place where these voices could be heard along with my own voice. And I'm very pleased about this, but I've been fortunate to get an endorsement from Rabbi Harold Kushner, who wrote When Bad Things Happen to Good People, saying, thank you, Carolyn Pearson, for reminding us that the task of any religion is to teach us whom we are required to love, not whom we're entitled to hate. And because we have felt entitled, for whatever reason, entitled because we have maintained some special category of loathing for homosexual people that is no long, should never have been okay, but today is absolutely, without any question, not okay. We must renounce any entitlement that anybody has felt to have hatred or condemnation or ill feelings toward this section of our population. I love the writing of Eckhart Tolle. Maybe some of you have read his wonderful book, The Power of Now. And more recently, I have read A New Earth. But I quote a brief statement of Tolle in my book. By far, the greater part of violence that humans have inflicted on each other is not the work of criminals or the mentally deranged, but of normal, respectable citizens in the service of the collective ego. You construct a conceptual identity for an individual or group, and you say, this is who he is, this is who they are. All this strengthens the sense of separation between yourself and the other, whose otherness has become magnified to such an extent that you can no longer feel your common humanity nor the rootedness in the one life that you share with each human being, your common divinity. This creation of the other is something that happens sometimes just instantly. I've been given permission to quote from Don Holsinger this statement, a BYU professor. Lest anyone doubt that total rejection by LDS families of gay family members is commonplace, let me pass along a recent personal experience. At a Salt Lake City meeting of gay university students, a former student of mine at BYU recognized my wife and me. We asked him about his experience at BYU and how he was getting along in his life now that he had come out to his parents. He told us that he was the first of 9 children and beloved of his parents. He was gifted academically, a talented musician, and a returned missionary. However, when he told his mother that he was gay, he said she told him to gather his belongings immediately, leave the house, and never return. That the idea, my child is gay, could be so powerful as to interrupt the years of maternal devotion is just staggering. Now, it's my expectation, my belief, and I don't know where that story went, but I have seen a lot of stories where this kind of shock happened, and then after some period of time, there has been some bridges built, and it's my hope that that has been the case for that family. One of my own favorite texts is A Course in Miracles, which reminds me that everything that comes from love is a miracle and brings about oneness, that whatever does not come from love comes from fear and contributes to the illusion of separation, separation from God and from one another. And I ask in my section here, can we be kind if we see others as a different kind? If I look at you as a gay person and see you as a different kind from me, of course I can't. And so in this book, I hope to introduce the readers to their own kind, their own kin, knowing that, and as that wonderful Jewish saying goes, an enemy is someone whose story you do not know. Stories are so powerful. And so I am thrilled in this new book to be able to share so many stories, heartbreaking stories, and very, very thrilling stories. I choose to deal with the worst first in my book, of the terrible stories of the suicides. And those of you who read the fine series that the Deseret News had a couple of months ago, you may remember that Utah has the distinction of having the highest suicide rate in the nation for young men between the ages of 15 and 24. And it's acknowledged that about a third of those would be gay young men. Now, lesbians have a difficult time too, but suicide seems to be very much something that men do, particularly in the stories that we are acquainted with and that Affirmation has documented. You're all acquainted with perhaps the most well-publicized story of Stuart Madison. I do mention some things of him here. I tell the story of my dear friend Brad. And when I first spoke to him, as I was at a luncheon table having spoken to an Affirmation group, he looked at me with his most beautiful, guileless brown eyes and said, "Sister Pearson, I'm just so sorry. You know what breaks my heart?" I said, "Brad, what breaks your heart?" "Well, that I can never be where people like you and God and Jesus are." I was just speechless. But he really, truly believed that. He had been out of the church for a long time, but he maintained so much love and devotion and belief. And after long a conversation, he said, "Oh, I wish I had a friend like you." I said, "Brad, I'll be your friend." So I gave him my phone number, and he became my friend and my computer teacher, and he came out and helped in the yard and did various things. Dearest, sweetest man. And he told me his story. He, like so many, 100% homosexual in every spontaneous feeling he ever had. Joined the Mormon Church as a teenager, loved the Mormon Church perhaps more than anybody I have ever talked to. It gave him something he had never had before. He truly believed he was going to be changed. He went on a mission, truly believed when he came back he would be changed. Didn't happen. Went to his campus bishop once a week for a blessing for this miracle. And after a year of a weekly blessing, he knew that nothing was ever going to happen to change him, and that he did not have a place in the church. So he decided that since he, in his mind, was destined to go to the lowest kingdom, he'd just as well go now. Brad gathered up a lot of pills, took them one evening, knew he had about 15 minutes before they took effect, drove up to the Provo Temple, sat there on a bench to die, choosing that place because he thought there would have to be kind angels hovering around that space who would take him in and be kind to him. As I heard Brad's stories, my heart just broke. And he would sob and say things like, "Carolyn, the Mormon Church has got to stop being so condemning of us. To be condemned by something as wonderful as the Mormon Church is more than a person can bear." Brad, though he had not been promiscuous, did have several partners, and he contracted AIDS, and he did die. And I have invited him to be on my welcoming committee when I finally get over there. Hopefully not for a long time, because I still do my carrot juicing and all that good stuff. But Brad and Gerald and all my other good friends, gay and whatever else, I want to have them all there. And I know they are not going to be assigned to some other place. And to help others who somehow are fixed in those false beliefs is something that I am still committed to, and I know that so many of you are here. The other category of unfortunate goodbyes that are said to ill-fated marriages this is another very, very difficult one. And of course, most people here know that that my daughter, Emily, and Stephen contracted a marriage that was not fated to endure. Under the belief system that both of these very good people had intact, that this was the right thing to do, to please God. And I believe they both did try to the very best of their abilities. And this was not something that could be a marriage of the kind that all of us want to have a marriage. And so that marriage did end. As did so many others that have been contracted under the very best of intentions and given the best of the two people involved. And while our church no longer holds up marriage as a therapy for homosexuality, nevertheless, we know that from day one, all of us are taught that there really is one road that we must take if we are going to please our Heavenly Father. And the sad harvest of all of that, I have so many little snippets here. Dear Carolyn, I closed your book, sat and cried for Gerald, for you, for me, for all who have been fed false hopes, whose lives are wasted trying to live up to all the dogmatic should-bes and ought-to-bes. How foolhardy, cowardly, to succumb to what others said was my responsibility in life, and that at 26 I was shirking my responsibility by not marrying and bearing as many children as I could. I have reaped bitterness for the choice made 22 years ago to marry a man. There is within me an unsatiable hunger, a loneliness that is indescribable. When I admitted to myself I had fallen in love with a woman, I talked with my bishop who sent me to a psychiatrist. I visited social workers, psychologists. They thought of me as a sinner but said I could change. Change to what? Change to them meant conformity. Can you force a fish to fly or a bird to swim? It would be easier to ask me to stop breathing than to try to deny the feelings I am told are evil. Carolyn, I am not evil. I am a hurting, lonely, fearful human being, angry at a God that has given me a burden I find intolerable. And so many like that. Here's from a man. I will keep going to Evergreen, you know, but that is the organization endorsed by the church to transition out of homosexuality. Not that I expect anything to change in the way that I experience my sexuality. I've tried too long. But it helps to know there are others like me, and we give each other encouragement to just hang in there. Breaking up my family is not an option for me anyway, and certainly not at my age. Is my glass half empty or half full? I try not to look at the empty half. The full half contains lots of blessings, and I keep my eye there. I love and appreciate my wife enormously, but I experience sex as obeying the letter of the law with no way of obeying the spirit of the law. Sex is like being a stranger in a strange land, like going through the motions of something that should be wonderful but isn't. Still, I'm here for the long haul. My wife deserves so much more, but every time we talk about it, she tells me our love is enough. I have no belief that what I would be giving up should I leave would be worth what I might gain. Well, of course, marriage is an individual thing, and the marriages between a straight person and a gay person that are satisfactory for their goals are marriages that must be honored. But the ones that are such a heartbreak are the ones that go into it with totally unrealistic expectations, and the ones that I hope we can discourage. The family stories, there are heartbreaking stories there. But I have been so thrilled to fill more than half of my book here with wonderful stories of LDS families letting nothing come between them and their gay kids. This is not a current one. This happened maybe, I don't know, a few some years ago, but I found this so moving. A woman sent me the whole story, and I condensed it down into this one paragraph. When my son told me he was gay, he said, "Please, please, Mama, don't stop loving me." I said, "Oh, my boy, I can never stop loving you. Years later, when he said, "Mama, I have AIDS," I sobbed so that he disappeared for months and would not answer the phone. After my emergency surgery, he called and said, "Mama, I'm so sorry. I love you so much." And I said, "Oh, and I love you too. I love you too." When he moved home and asked, "Mama, am I going to die?" I said, "No, no, we're going to bicycle through Europe together." And then I went to the garage where only the washer and dryer would see me weep. When in the hospital, his 205 pounds had melted to 76, he said, "Mama, I want to go home." And against the doctor's orders, I took him. I rubbed his feet until I thought he was asleep, and then he would say, "Oh, please, Mama, just for a little while longer." On Christmas Eve, I carried him to the balcony overlooking the living room, where he could see the fireplace and the big flocked Christmas tree with a star on top. He put his head on my shoulder and he said, "Mama, am I going to die now? Am I really going to die now?" The tears were falling on our cheeks, and I said, "Yes, darling, you are. Did you know the lions really do lie down with the lambs? There will be no more pain. You can go home to our Heavenly Father now." He looked up at my face and he said, "I sure do love you, Mama." After he was gone, I went back to the hospital many times to see those dear, sweet other boys, many alone with no family to care for them in their last days. I ran around to all the beds and gave hugs and kisses. They beamed, and I thought I could hear my own son say again, "Mama, Mama, I sure do love you, Mama." There are so many LDS parents who are parenting their own kids and those who come to them so beautifully. And I give honor to so many of them. Some of them are here, and I'm so grateful for them. Of all the family stories that I could tell, I remember the stake patriarch father who 15 years ago with his Relief Society president wife went to the commitment ceremony of my friend Sakoki in Southern California, where the whole several hundred voice chorus of the gay men's chorus was there at the ceremony, and the stake patriarch and his wife danced at that ceremony. And I remember the bishop who, upon being given the information that a young gay man had come back for the to be with the family for the missionary farewell of his younger sister, heard that the next day was going to be read this letter that we all know, urging the people to contact their senators about the protection of marriage amendment. But the mother of this young man desperately calling the bishop, throwing herself on his mercy after her son said, "Oh, I don't know if I can go. I don't know if I can go and listen to that." And the mother called the bishop, and the bishop said, "Don't you worry about a thing." The bishop did not read the letter. There was nothing that interfered with the unity of that family during that weekend. Oh, so many stories that I wish I had time to tell you, and I want to leave time for the questions that I know you will have. Let me see if I can read my final section in the book. I'm one that has to move in a positive direction or else I can't get up in the morning. The road ahead. It is Easter morning, 2006. Is it breaking the Sabbath to begin this section? Master, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? I have been so looking forward to writing the end of this book, even though by pages I'm not there yet. I often like to jump ahead and write the ending. It helps me to know where I'm going. And so I am going to write of healing on this Sabbath, this Easter morning, before going to church. Sometimes I like to climb up in what I call my spiritual helicopter and look down at life on the earth. My own life, the life of the human family. I like to see where we're going, see where we've been, get a little perspective on today. The journey is one of consciousness. I'm very clear on that. Years ago, Gerald Ever, the philosopher, quoted to me something I can't repeat quite correctly, and I don't know who said it. The only battles that count are the battles fought on the field of consciousness. We can track consciousness from this high helicopter, you and I. We can see the darkness of unconsciousness illuminated from time to time by the light of consciousness. Look, they're hard to believe. We thought the gods appreciated human sacrifice. We thought it fine for one man to own another in slavery. We accepted the idea that women did not have souls. We were indifferent to the genocide of millions of Native Americans. Large numbers of us accepted that Hitler's ethnic cleansing was a fine idea. Looking down now at that slowly moving demarcation, that border of now, we see an ongoing birth of higher consciousness. It's not a straight climb, but surely it's three steps forward for everyone back. Where then will our consciousness be 10 years, 30 years, 50 years from now, assuming our world lasts? You have your list of hopes, I have mine. I hope and believe there will be more consciousness of our human family, being part of the larger creation, part of the environment. The feminine principle, both mortal and divine, will have established a stronger presence. We'll be closer to a ceasefire over who owns God. Our religions will have remembered that each has deeply embedded in its platform a version of the golden rule. We will have stopped creating divisions and instead celebrate our common humanity and divinity. We will be more reverent of the place and power of sexuality. Our heterosexual majority will have ceased reviling and persecuting our gay brothers and sisters, and we will look back and shake our heads and say, "Can you believe that in the name of religion, we drove these people to suicide?" Not an impossible dream, I think. I know the human family, and I say with Anne Frank, I still believe in spite of everything that people are really good at heart. I know the Mormon heart. It is a good and a great heart. It is a heart that opens wide whenever a need is seen. It is the heart of Sister Spencer, my visiting teacher that I wrote about in Goodbye, I Love You, who called me when she learned I had Gerald in my home dying. "I'm not calling," she said, "to tell you to let me know if you need anything. I'm calling to tell you to put by the phone a list of things that need to be done. I'm calling every morning at 9, and you're going to read the list to me, and the things will be done." It is also the heart that sent a couple of dozen of the ward brethren to my home on a weekend to paint the entirety of my large and weathered house. It is the heart that brought over 500 people in my stake to contribute and record children's books to send to the schools in Afghanistan as a project I headed for our stake Public Affairs Council. It is the heart that moved our humanitarian services in Salt Lake City hours before Hurricane Katrina hit to get on the road to Louisiana, 14 semi-trailers filled with water, tents, sleeping bags, tarps, generators, canned food, and hygiene kits. When we see a need, we respond. When we are conscious, we act. That new pioneer journey I spoke of in the first part of this book is a journey of consciousness. Now that you have read the stories of anguish and of healing, have met our gay loved ones and their parents, sisters, brothers, and friends who have circled the wagons around them, you have journeyed in consciousness and have, I believe, arrived at a new place. Now you know. I began this book with a Mormon pioneer image, and I want to end with another one. Many of us have heard this story. I expect to type it through tears today, as some of you may read it through tears. It was 1856. The last handcart companies were on the plains headed for Utah. Anxious to join the body of the saints and fueled by an unrealistic zeal, they had started late in the season and were ill prepared for an early Wyoming winter. The Martin Company of 600 found themselves stopped at the Sweetwater, unable to go on. They waited. They died. On October 4th, as the riders reached Salt Lake City on Saturday to tell of their plight. The next day was General Conference of the church, and 12,000 had gathered to hear the words of their leader, Brigham Young. Brigham arose and addressed the congregation, saying, I will now give this people the subject and the text for the conference. It is this. On the fifth day of October, many of our brethren and sisters are on the plains with handcarts, and they must be brought in. We must send assistance to them. Our text will be to get them here. I shall call upon the bishops this day. I shall not wait for tomorrow. And then he goes on to ask for 60 good mule teams, 12 or 15 wagons, this many of that and that. And he says, go now and bring in those people now on the plains. Reminding them that their religion will never save any of them unless they carry out just such principles as he's teaching them then. Today, I have ridden in with a report that I feel is an urgent one. I am not the only rider, but I'm the one you are hearing now. There are large numbers of our homosexual people who are safe and warm, who have the highest self-esteem, and have healthy relationships with their families and friends and with God. For many of them, that well-being has been purchased at a high price, and their scars are deep. But I speak to you now of those who are suffering today, a group of our own who have been caught in a fierce winter, a winter largely of our own making. Some of them are dying. You have read in this book about only a few, but across the human family there are millions. I'm asking you to look beyond your prejudice, your judgment, and see the human beings who have been left in the cold. It's too late for Stuart, who lived in constant torment and self-hatred. Too late for my dear Brad, who took pills at the Provo Temple, hoping that we'd be kind angels to receive him there. But it is not too late for thousands who struggle in the cold of misunderstanding. Today, there is a despondent Mormon gay man somewhere who was checked to see if his father's gun is still where it used to be. Tonight, there is a Mormon lesbian who again cries herself to sleep over her awful alternatives. You may choose between being gay or being a member of this family. Today there are parents whose tears are for the pain of their loved gay child, for the lack of support they receive from their church, for the condemning rhetoric they continue to hear, and for fear that the members of their ward might find out the family secret. Today there takes place in one of our temples a ceremony of eternal marriage for a young, gay, newly returned missionary, anxious for his eternal salvation and an eager, starry-eyed young bride who believes her groom's romantic restraint has come from his righteousness. These people are still on the plains. I am asking you to load up the wagons. You can do it even without fully understanding, without fully approving. You have the supplies, parcels of love, compassion, encouragement, respect, good information, and humility in knowing there is much about the situation we have yet to learn. You have the words of Jesus that inasmuch as ye have done it unto the least of these, ye have done it unto me. And you have the words that still echo across a century and a half, go and bring in those people now on the plains. The call goes out not only to the Mormon part of God's family, but to every other Christian, to Jews, to Muslims, to Buddhists, to all our cousins everywhere. Just now, as I wrote again and put in italics those pressing words mobilizing the rescue party, I realize I am speaking not only of those who have been harmed, but also of those who harm. All of us who have, in our arrogance, judged one another unkindly, looked at each other through the eyes of fear rather than the eyes of love. We too are out on the plains in a harsh winter, cold and without nourishment. And so I have to issue the same call to our gay friends and to their families and to every other group of people who have been misunderstood and abused. I ask you also to fill your wagons. Fill them with courage, with forgiveness, with patience, with exemplary behavior, and with an unwavering insistence that we can, we must, and we will move to higher ground. We take turns then, don't we? When you are caught on any plains where love is not, I will gather what I have and bring what I can. And when I have used up all my love and am stranded in the cold, I will watch for you to appear with fresh supplies. That way we can make it, I think, all of us. We can be sufficiently creative and sufficiently kind that we will draw circle upon circle, bringing each other in, leaving no one out, joining, linking, enlarging, until the pattern of the whole human family, seen through the eye of God, is complete. Thank you.
If you have questions or comments, please make your way to the microphone in the front so we can capture this on the tape. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn. I want to be sensitive to the question I'm going to ask to you and to Emily, and it's because of my daughters. As after my ex-wife read your book, one of the things that she said was that how could somebody allow their child to go with a gay man to any type of activity? So my question is, do you have any regrets about allowing your children to go with their gay father, and what advice would you give to those who are withholding their contact from their gay dad?
Yeah, that is difficult, and you can have a conversation with Emily after this, and I hope you will go to her session that's coming up next. And Stephen has a session coming up, and you may have seen his play, and all of these, there are so many things all intertwined here. And I do not have regrets for that I let my children and their father have a full relationship. I do realize now, which I did not realize then, that there were not good boundaries that I had expected were in place there, and that especially Emily was submitted to information and things that were not appropriate for her age. And Gerald, good man that he was, exercised very poor judgment on a lot of occasions. And that's a difficult thing to work around. So every situation is different. I say in general, a child needs to have both of their parents. In general, a gay father is not going to be a detriment to the children. Every situation is different. And if you want to talk to me personally more, or Emily more, or any others, I'm sure we would be glad to do that. Here, Emily gets to speak now.
All I have to say to that is that my father's boundaries had absolutely nothing to do with his homosexuality. It was him as a person, and a person's homosexuality has absolutely nothing to do with their ability to parent at all.
I think your ability to write is such a blessing to all of us, and we might feel these things, but you can say them. One of the great things that you're providing a basis for truly being able to say to this culture is inclusion. And there's no way, I think, the Mormon community can move forward without inclusion. And what you just said was absolutely on the mark. My question is, what do you think is possible with a culture taking that road in respect to what needs to be done, as opposed to us waiting for the ecclesiastical leadership to have a vision, which they don't, to that point? It seems to me that the answer must come from the families, from the culture, and from people like that bishop saying, no more. And do you have a sense that the culture is making that shift, irregardless of what the ecclesiastical leadership says?
Well, certainly. And we are not privy to all of the meetings that go on with the brethren. My heart happens to have to believe that they are very concerned and want for everybody to be happy and want for families to be together. I cannot believe that these men are unconcerned. I believe that you know, certain things are their business, certain things are God's business, certain things are our business. And personally, I'm trying to stay in my own business on this. And my business is to tell the stories. My business is, as a member of the family in this Mormon community, to speak out loud and say, did you know that my sister and my brother are in real pain? To say that loud enough that the parents can hear, that all of the older brothers and sisters can hear, that is not only my right, but my responsibility. And I think that the responsibility of all of us is just to speak a little louder. To take whatever decision anybody here has made about the church, if your intent is just to stay within, to do so with a clear conscience and a voice that will not be silenced. I think there are a lot of things going on that we're not seeing, especially down here at the bottom where bishops deal with the problem on an ongoing basis. Just, 10 days ago, Emily and I were both on Radioactive, Troy Williams' program, and it was such a wonderful hour. We had such a good time, and there were callers toward the end. One man called in with a devastatingly awful story of things between him and his father, and practically becoming violent. But the caller that I think we all remember is that wonderful bishop. And here, just suddenly on there, here was this fine male voice saying, I'm an LDS bishop. Can you please tell me, how can we bishops do better what we need to do to help the situation and to help the families who are struggling with this? And he said, in my ward, we just had a situation where a young man came out to his family, and I was working with them and, of course, encouraged them to maintain together. And they've done, I think, a really fine job, he said, to maintain. And all they have learned now about their son is one more piece of information that he's gay. But he said, I have a feeling that this might be an exception to the case. And how can we do things better? So there is a lot in motion of a lot of people wanting to do things better and not knowing how. And, of course, the first step is just to acknowledge we don't have all the answers, to accept the very best scientific information as it comes in to help us understand what is this phenomenon, and then to say, you know, somehow our bonds of love have to be stronger than to allow the disruption in families and in friendships. And then when we get some of these things better in place, we'll know what the next step is. And then we'll know what the step after that is. But it has to be one step at a time. And we're all involved in whatever step we have been assigned in this journey. Somebody else?
I just want to say first that whenever I hear homosexuality discussed as an illness or something that can and should be cured, it makes me want to throw up. I mean, it's just, that's disgusting to me. And I was looking through my school library the other day, and I saw this book. It was, I believe it was by an LDS author. It was called Coming Out Straight, and the subtitle was Curing Our Unnatural Homosexual Tendencies. And it just boggles my mind that the church endorses and supports that point of view. And I believe that if simply the church and, I mean, the people in the church simply stopped doing that, then there'd be a lot less cases like this and a lot less hurt and pain in these families, it'd be a lot less of a big deal that somebody in their family is homosexual, because there'd be less hubbub and less trying to get them to change and looking at them as if they're less than and they need to be put in a hospital somewhere and fixed or have some surgery that will magically change them. I mean, specifically in my experience, not personally my experience, my two eldest sisters, their father is gay, their biological father. And my mom, when she found out, she went and to her bishop, not to say, you know, how do I fix him, but ask for what she should do in a situation like that. And he told her that it was her fault that he was gay.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was her fault, and that she should go home and make herself available, and then that will change him. And that if she divorced him, that it was a sin. And
yeah, well, clearly we have been steeped in enormous misinformation. And it's inexcusable if we continue to perpetuate that kind of information. Now, certainly, our language today has improved over the language of, you know, 20 years ago. We don't hear brand new statements that carry some of the worst of the old language, you know, of abomination and evil choice and all of that. And today, of course, we hear much more about control than we do even about change. So, you know, you're right about everything. We just have to acknowledge that we have a very bad history with this, and where we are right now is better than that, but we are not yet in the promised land. And what exactly that will look like, we'll just have to find out when we get there.
Yes, I appreciate this very much. I want to first tell very briefly a positive story. My brother is gay. He came out about 12 years ago and told the family. And our parents are deceased. But I'm very happy that the family, by and large, is still supportive of Robert. We still get together and do things. Their marriage ended in divorce, but they're still a very close family. They had two grown children now, and they just get together on holidays and everything. He has a gay partner now that they've lived with for 10 years. It's a minister in the United Church of Christ. And so it can be positive. I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be positive in all cases, because, you know, if you... but the thing that's bothering me right now that I'd like you to address, perhaps, is when I hear these things, I get extremely angry at God. Now, why? From a Mormon point of view, if the brethren are asking God for revelation or clarification on this, I mean, I can't see why you wouldn't... The only reason I can see you can be angry at a homosexual is you want to be one too. And, or else you think that you're doing God's will to oppose this based on the few statements that are in the Bible. And so, if the brethren are asking and they're not getting an answer, then I tend to blame God.
Well, really?
Because I'm glad to be doing that. And so I want to know if you can help me so I don't feel this way. I mean, it just breaks my heart to hear these stories
I just heard God say, don't blame me. I'm speaking to you as well as to anybody else. And whatever rests...
Well, see, I have a hard time with hearing God speak to me. I guess it's my trouble.
Why? Why? Don't you deserve to hear the voice of God?
I haven't quite decided... whether to be a Christian or an atheist yet.
Well, so. Okay. Now, whatever that confusion is all about, do not blame God
okay.
for anybody's
I mean, I don't
absurdity.
Want to. I think that the trouble is that religion corrupts God. If we had a true
our
religion...
Our perception of God.
Our perception of God, okay. They don't... You know, I can't deal... But I'm focusing on me instead of the gay people. I just... There's such an easy solution to this. You simply accept them, say, and treat them just like you would any other human being.
And as you do that,
and let them have a partner that they can do.
As you do that personally, you are doing the work of God.
We'll hope that
everybody else tries to do the work of God.
It still makes me angry.
Well, then turn that into love and go out and do something with it.
So.
Okay, all right. I believe that.
I'd like to pay tribute to Carolyn Pearson. I believe we have a mother in heaven. I believe Carolyn is a goddess.
All in favor signify by the usual sign. Okay.
Who is so loving that she has come down to spend time to comfort us where we have been neglected.
Oh, Si, so bless your little heart.
Thank you for coming down and spending time with us.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you so much. All right. Okay. Do we have any more time? Okay.
Thanks. This is kind of a little bit of a technical question, but when you think, our thinking about homosexuality is often inseparable with our thinking about AIDS, the disease, and the stories that we tell often have that as an important component. When you think about it, the broad issue, which can be separated from the disease itself, is that helpful to you, or do you think...
Oh, they're very separate to me.
They're very separate to you.
Oh, yeah.
But yet, the story so often not only have the pain and suffering of rejection from society, but the physical suffering of death and the disease itself, and they seem to be intertwined pretty closely.
Well... Sure, and I think in the past, most especially, certainly in those awful times when Gerald lived out the awful days of the 80s, and there was very much, we kind of had this bag where they were together. I totally do not have them together in my mind as I address these issues. Most of us understand, all of us understand, in terms of the sexuality, how to avoid AIDS, and I think we're all kind of stunned when somebody contracts AIDS that way now, because it is a very avoidable thing now. So the people that I the gay people that I talk to, and the people who are in long-term partnerships, that's way over there in my mind when I'm looking at how people are dealing with the subject now and trying to create relationships that they can be totally safe and committed to one another, and AIDS doesn't have to enter into it. I think we're done now. Thank you all, and let us go forward and each do our good work. Thank you.